Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Shape in the Dark, Living and Dying with Brown Bears by Bjorn Dila. Narrated by John McLean. Prologue. In August of 2004, I borrowed my friend Forrest Wagner's ancient pickup truck in Fairbanks and headed north. I had a couple weeks before my classes would begin at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I hoped to climb Mount Dunarak in the central Brooks Range. As I drove through graveyards of charred, spindly black spruce rising in the smoke from forest fires, the Alaska pipeline appeared every so often in the gray. The silhouette of the Brooks Range shone hazy in the smoke. I hid Forrest's truck in a willow thicket 10 miles south of the Continental Divide, shouldered my backpack, and began hiking up an ember-tinted valley. The muddy creek banks were lined with grizzly tracks and caribou bones. I traveled into the mountains, past herds of dull sheep that watched me warily. At my second camp, I woke to a gray wolf howling from a nearby knoll. 2 dark wolves, the wild amber of their eyes electrifying the soft glow of the early morning, walked by within yards of my tent. I wandered deeper into the country, following caribou trails past antler sheds lying on the tundra, a mute testament to life in the heavy silence. 2 wolves half-heartedly stalked a large dull sheep ram as I watched in the distance. When I tried to climb Dunarak, I was thwarted by a series of steep, crumbly ridges and cliffs. On my second attempt, I followed a ridge that became too exposed and technical. September came. I was going to be late for classes, but still, I made one last attempt on Dunarak. I found a route that, though it crossed some dangerously steep scree slopes, got me to the base of the summit. The top was an hour away, and appeared to be a relatively easy rock scramble, but black clouds blew in, and snow began to fall. Hours later, as the storm broke and temperatures skyrocketed back close to 70 degrees, I sat outside my tent, wishing I hadn't turned back. I didn't want to return to Fairbanks, but I was out of food. A porcupine waddled by, and I leapt to my feet and grabbed a large rock. I crept up behind the animal, raised the rock over my head, and then hesitated. Rugged mountains rose indifferently into the pale blue sky as I watched the porcupine continue until it disappeared into the tundra. I broke camp and began to trek out. Late that night, the temperature plummeted, the wind picked up, and snow began to fall. By morning, a full storm battered my tent. I unzipped the door a crack and peered out to see a herd of several dozen sheep bedded nearby in the lee of the blizzard. In the early afternoon, I broke camp and trudged through a 4-inch blanket of snow. In a low valley, I watched a grizzly grazing on the last of the year's blueberries. It was smaller than the coastal brown bears I was familiar with, brutally muscled and unaware of my presence. I edged past into thick willows with wind hard on my face. Once I was several hundred yards away, since I was traveling through brush with a lot of bear sign, I began singing 1980s power ballads to warn other animals. An hour later, while taking a few minutes' break from making noise, I emerged into a small clearing and nearly stepped on a grizzly. For a second, before I remembered to be afraid, I was overcome by its sheer presence. Dark brown, with silver forelegs, incredibly muscled and poised, it appeared too real to be real. A moment later, our eyes met. Fear and rage flashed in its small brown eyes. It closed the distance separating us in one stride as I reached for my bear spray attached to my pack strap. There wasn't time to unclip it. There wasn't even time to realize the bear was about to knock me down, and what that might mean. But instead of smashing me, the bear stopped short, at what felt like only inches away, and recoiled to the side. I took a step back and was fumbling with my pepper spray when the bear came again, and just before contact seemed inevitable, bounded away. For the longest seconds of my life, we engaged in a strange and violent dance, until the bear crashed off into the willows. It was only then that I had the pepper spray in my hand and ready. During the rest of the hike out, every set of grizzly tracks I came across seemed to radiate with the promise of death. At any moment, I expected a bear to emerge from the mountains and come for me. At Coldfoot, the one gas station between Fairbanks and Prudhoe Bay, I picked up two Japanese hitchhikers who'd come to Fairbanks in search of the Northern Lights. In most of the interior that summer, visibility was limited to a couple hundred yards due to smoke from forest fires. Instead of leaving defeated, they'd hitchhiked north a few hundred miles, far enough from the fires to where they made out a faint green glimmer in the sky one night. "We see Aurora Borealis. Then we wait on the side of the road for 3 days. No one would pick us up. So cold. Now we know why they call it Coldfoot," the younger of the two said. He was close to my age. Much to his parents' disapproval, he decided to travel for a year before finishing a college degree in economics. "I don't want to go back to Japan," he said. "My family wants me to go to school, get married, and work, work, work." The other man was older and possessed a calm intensity. His English wasn't good, but I learned that he'd been traveling for more than a decade. "I never go back to Japan," he said. "I just go." We rode through thick smoke and smoldering black spruce without seeing another vehicle for over an hour. At one point, small fires burned along both sides of the road, and I began to worry I might get us killed. When I mentioned that I was thinking about turning back to Coldfoot, they encouraged me to keep driving south. I dropped them off in downtown Fairbanks at a hostel. At the university, I fumbled through the proper motions, stared at the eastern Alaska mountain range, and felt lost. Instead of renting a cabin or room, I pitched my tent in the woods a few miles from campus. October came. With the first snow, the fires and smoke vanished, revealing blue sky, stars, and the occasional display of northern lights. At night, I listened to small forest animals, or silence, or the panting and grunting of a rutting bull moose, or the soft hissing of falling snow, or the screeching of a lynx. And I thought of the bear. I thought of how close it had come to maiming, even killing me. I thought of how the threat of death made me realize how deeply in love with life I was. I woke at the smallest changes in the forest and wondered if the bear had traveled 300 miles south to find me. In the morning, I watched my pet mouse raiding the food bag and wondered what the bear was doing at that exact moment. What was it thinking? What was it feeling? Did it remember me? Was it in its winter den yet? I tried to apply myself to my studies, but there seemed little of truth or worth to be found. I missed the wild expanse where words, concepts, and beliefs meant nothing. I missed the wind and open horizon. I missed the mountains and the tundra. Most of all, I missed the bear. Introduction. On October 1st, 2018, my two brothers and I packed the meat, bones, and hide of a mountain goat down a mountain in northern southeast Alaska. Near the ocean, we walked through an estuary that had been rototilled by hungry bears digging roots. The salmon runs and berries had failed that year. We paused to get water from a stream as the sunset illuminated mountains and ocean in soft layers of red. A fresh set of brown bear tracks crossed in the sand. Its human-like hind track was a little over a foot long, and its pigeon-toed front track was over 8 inches wide. I guessed it would stand more than 8 feet on its hind legs and weigh close to 800 pounds, a large male in this region. Using our headlamps, we traveled through darkness, following the same game trail the bear was traveling through the forest. I thought how by now, up on the mountain, all that remained of the goat was a stain of blood and offal, and a few bones that had already been picked clean by eagles and ravens. Soon a wolf, bear, or wolverine would crunch them to feast on marrow, and then the broken remains would be reabsorbed by the mountain. My light illuminated gnarled trees rising into the black, and I yelled out a warning to the bear. I knew it could hear me, and sensing its restlessness, I thanked it for allowing my brothers and me to pass through the woods. Late that night, after I made it home, I learned that a young man had been killed by a brown bear on nearby Admiralty Island that morning. The man had been an 18-year-old Oklahoman who had just arrived in Alaska and begun a job as a driller's assistant. He and another worker had been helicoptered to a remote drilling site leased by the Hecla Greens Creek Mining Company high in the mountains on the island. The press release and newspaper articles that followed had few details as to what happened. I would hear later, from people with ties to the mine, that the young man had walked away from the drill pad to check a hose or look for water. Neither of the men had been armed. When the Oklahoman didn't return, the other contractor went looking and found a female bear with two big cubs, eating him. The man radioed for help, summoning a helicopter, which tried to buzz the bears off the body. The bears wouldn't leave, and were shot several times with a .375 rifle from the air, killing them. This book is about our relationship with brown bears, which, in case there's any confusion, is the same species as the grizzly bear. During the last 20 years, I've spent a significant amount of time exploring wild places across Alaska, and for most of the last decade, worked as a guide, taking people and film crews throughout southeast Alaska to watch and film brown bears. Before and even after beginning this project, there have been times I almost hated bears. Like most feelings of hostility, mine were rooted in fear. Yet there is no place I love more than grizzly country, and no animal has intrigued and challenged me more than the bear. I grew up in Juneau and live on nearby Douglas Island, both of which are just a few miles boat ride from Admiralty Island. The roughly 100-mile by 17-mile island lies in the northern section of the Alexander Archipelago, a group of over 1,000 rainforest islands in southeast Alaska. The archipelago and the adjacent rugged mainland comprise the Tongass National Forest. Established by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1907, the Tongass is wet, wild, and America's largest national forest at nearly 26,500 square miles. Admiralty is part of the ABC Islands, Admiralty, Baranof, Chichagof, and though most folks have never heard of them, Jacobi and Kruzoff Islands, which make up the northern part of the Alexander Archipelago. These five islands are ecologically similar. Historically, they have big runs of salmon and a lot of brown bears and Sitka black-tailed deer. The true name of Admiralty is Kootsnawu, which in Lingit, the language of the Tlingit people who lived in southeast Alaska since time immemorial, translates to something like Fortress of the Bears. Admiralty is known for its exceptionally dark, even black, brown bears. These black grizzlies were once commonly called Shiras bears and used as a rallying cry for conservationists who fought to keep the island from being clear-cut. For the most part, the only people who still use the term Shiras are old-timers who remember the battle for Admiralty. The island's bear population is roughly estimated at 1 per square mile, meaning that it likely has more brown bears than the entire lower 48. It had been nearly a century since someone had been killed on Admiralty by a bear. Both deaths could have been avoided and were the result of people having little understanding of bears. Nearly every documented brown bear fatality in southeast Alaska has occurred late in the year when bears enter a state of hyperphagia. The one exception is a garbage bear that ate a man in Hyder, a tiny community near Alaska's southern border with Canada, in July of 2000. Each fall, when the salmon runs peter out, an internal switch goes off in bears and makes them more voracious and often agitated. On Admiralty and neighboring islands, they spend more time in the high country feeding on berries and anything else with caloric value. A bear has to gain around 30% of what it weighed in the spring, or it won't survive the long winter sleep. Far fewer people die at the teeth and claws of brown bears in Alaska than most people realize. There were no documented fatalities in the state from 2006 until the fall of 2012, when two men died in separate attacks. There were no fatalities from 2013 until the summer of 2018, when a man was killed in Eagle River near Anchorage. In contrast, nearly 2,000 of Alaska's estimated population of 30,000 to 40,000 brown bears are killed by sport hunters annually. In the Kodiak Archipelago alone, 600 miles west of Admiralty Island, $5 million is spent on bear hunts each year, and around 180 bears are killed. There's been only one documented case of a bear killing someone there in the last 75 years, so the demon monster mythology often applied to bears and perpetuated by media is far from the truth. Brown bears are generally not aggressive toward people unless threatened or surprised at close quarters, and those encounters are usually relatively easy to avoid. Still, there's no way to make bears safe, although people have tried and failed. I put my share of goat meat and bones in the refrigerator, took a beer into the shower, and then lay in bed, unable to sleep. My body was exhausted, but my mind wouldn't turn off. The residue of the goat's blood smelled subtle and sweet. My partner, MC, pregnant with our first child, snored gently next to me. Our golden retriever, Finn, shifted and laid her head on my foot. Still unable to sleep, I moved to the living room and stared out at the black of a mountain rising from the ocean in the darkness. The lights of Juneau shone weakly to the north across Gastineau Channel. I imagined the big bear, whose tracks my brothers and I had followed earlier, resting at the base of an ancient tree or prowling the night in search of something to ease its hunger. I thought of the fetus that was my kid, floating in amniotic fluid and protected from the world by a few thin layers of MC's flesh. I thought of the Oklahoman's parents and felt a tightening in my guts. Pouring whiskey into a mason jar, I remembered how the fall before, while deer hunting on Admiralty Island, I'd come upon a den on a steep slope beneath a giant spruce tree. A bear had recently excavated piles of dirt. Chances were the animal lay feet away, asleep atop a bed of moss in the darkness. The hair on the back of my neck stood up. I quietly chambered a round in my rifle and held it to my shoulder. Taking a step back, I glanced about the shadowy rainforest. I imagined the bear rushing forth from the earth and charging down the mountain away from me. Then I imagined it rushing forth from the earth, knocking me down and eating me. Nothing but my breathing and heartbeat disturbed the quiet. Then I crept closer and peered inside the den, like a moth drawn toward a flame. I studied the darkness inside my condo and then looked out at the darkness outside the window. After a while, much like our ancestors who built fires to keep away the monsters, I opened my laptop and stared at the lit-up screen, hoping the words would come. Part 1 Chapter 1 The Skin of the Bear. This animal is the monarch of the country which he inhabits. The African lion or the tiger of Bengal are not more terrible or fierce. He is the enemy of man and literally thirsts for human blood. So far from shunning, he seldom fails to attack and even to hunt him. The Indians make war upon these ferocious monsters with the same ceremonies as they do upon a tribe of their own species, and in the recital of their victories, the death of one of them gives the warrior greater renown than the scalp of a human enemy. Henry Marie Brackenridge, Views of Louisiana. I first encountered a brown bear when I was 4 or 5 years old. It was lying in a salmon stream on Admiralty Island, reduced to bones, pieces of hide, and tendrils of flesh. Thick salmonberry brush and giant trees rose above each bank, offering the illusion of impenetrable walls. A bald eagle glided past and landed on a log jam. Ravens spoke their ancient language from the boughs of Sitka spruce trees. Pink salmon filled the stream and struggled to spawn. Leaving the bear, I waded downstream toward an old cabin my family was staying at. I paused to throw rocks at a belly-up salmon who just laid the rest of her eggs as she drifted downstream toward the ocean. I found my dad and took him back to the carcass, where he cradled his rifle and studied the surrounding salmonberry bushes and jungle. Dad had moved to Alaska from California when he was in his early 20s so he could hunt and experience wilderness. The brown bear has always been a big, mysterious animal to him, something that you have to respect and watch out for. The carcass that lay at our feet wasn't much bigger than me, though. It was likely a 2-year-old, the typical age for a cub to be run off by its mother so she could mate again. In the day or two since it had been killed, other bears, eagles, and ravens had reduced it to little more than a skeleton and a tattering of flesh. The stream's current and the falling rain added to the forces, encouraging blood from flesh and flesh from bone. In the shallows, on the gravel bars, and on the banks nearby were the carcasses of countless decomposing salmon. Even the living salmon, splashing against the current, jockeying for position and digging out reds, were in the process of dying. I stood beside my dad with little understanding of what was going on. I can't recall my thoughts, but maybe I suffered a glimmer of awareness. Maybe I imagined a bear crashing through the woods, engulfing me in its jaws, and how even if I escaped its grip, eventually, like the spawning salmon, my blood, flesh, and guts would still be freed of my bones and carried away from the thing I thought was me. We left the carcass, and I followed my dad downstream, staring up at the brush and alders lining the banks, where bear trails led into the unknown. In October of 1809, Meriwether Lewis traveled by horseback through the Tennessee hills, bound for Washington, D.C., to report to President James Madison. 8 years prior, just after taking office, President Thomas Jefferson had handpicked Lewis to be his personal secretary. Jefferson dreamed of building a country that stretched from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and he believed that Lewis was the man to set the groundwork to make it a reality. The two became extremely close, their relationship taking on the dynamic of a wise and visionary father grooming his prodigy son for a quest of mythic proportions. Lewis had not only succeeded in leading the Corps of Discovery, also known as the Lewis and Clark Expedition, across the continent and back again, making him one of the most famous men in the country, but afterward, Jefferson appointed him governor of the Louisiana Territory, a swath of wild country encompassing more than half of the young United States at the time. Jefferson and the entire nation were waiting eagerly for the young captain to edit and publish his expedition journals and maps, but Lewis seemed unable to focus or articulate what he'd experienced. Time was up, though. President Madison had demanded his report, and Lewis could stall no longer. What, if anything, Lewis saw in the Tennessee forest as he traveled can only be guessed. By all accounts, he was drunk, irritable, and lost in a schizophrenic loneliness he couldn't claw his way out of. Some guessed his poor health was related to his inability to find a wife. He was good-looking, famous, and well-off, although he had money problems. Finding a wife should have been easy, unless, as many historians believe, he was a little off. There's talk of syphilis or malaria-induced madness, alcoholism, and other addictions, not to mention the groundless rumors he was gay. There's no question he was suffering from depression, anxiety, and excessive drinking. No one, at least no one who talked about it in public, really knew Lewis's inner world. Lewis tried to kill himself twice en route to Washington. It's unclear exactly how. His companions disarmed him and placed him under watch. After days of erratic behavior while detoxing, he appeared to return to reason and continued on his journey. The night of October 10th, Lewis rode ahead and took a room at Grinder's Inn on the Natchez Trace Trail. The inn was owned and operated by Priscilla Grinder and her husband, but the latter was away on business. Lewis claimed to have been unable to sleep in a bed since returning from the expedition, so he had his servant spread out a grizzly skin and his buffalo robe on his cabin's floor. Perhaps he lay in the thick, wild-smelling fur for a while before his racing thoughts and despair became too much. He took to pacing the room and talking loudly, even yelling to himself, and walking circles around the pelts of the two animals that best symbolized the American West. What was the story behind each animal? Lewis and the expedition had killed so many bison that it was unlikely the robe had any more significance to the captain than warmth and fashion. The bear pelt, on the other hand, was different. For Lewis, no other animal in North America compared to the brown bear. It represented the most mysterious and dangerous elements of the wilderness of the New World. Even the woolly mammoth, which at the beginning of the expedition Jefferson and Lewis had speculated still existed in the North American wild, paled in comparison. The brown bear first migrated from Asia across the Bering Land Bridge to North America around 100,000 years ago. There it met a host of ferocious predators like steppe lions, saber-toothed cats, dire wolves, and, kings over all, giant, short-faced bears. With a 14-foot arm span, the short-faced bear weighed a ton and on all fours stood eye-level with a grown man. Its skull looked like a cross between a bear's and tiger's. There are some opinions that the short-faced bear blocked brown bears from migrating south, and whether that's true or not, little fossil evidence shows brown bears in the contiguous United States until 13,000 years ago, when the short-faced bear and much of the continent's megafauna appeared to have died at the spears and wit of the Clovis people and environmental factors brought on by climate change. The Clovis were some of the first people to migrate across Beringia, and their culture evolved to hunt and survive the megafauna of America. Their spears had heads between 2 and 9 inches in length, attached to wooden shafts that could be thrown, jabbed, and even braced against the ground to impale a charging animal. A spear may not seem like much when faced with the zoological reality of the time, but the Clovis people successfully spread across the continent hunting mammoths, mastodons, giant ground sloths, and a wide array of ungulates. Following along in the fossil record, not long after nearly all the megafauna vanished, the Clovis spearheads disappeared, replaced with weaponry suited for smaller and less fierce animals. For 13,000 years, the versatile brown bear reigned supreme in the animal world. The bear's survival was a testament to its intelligence, omnivorous diet, and adaptability, including its ability to go into a torpor during months with low food availability. The brown bear's range extended from the Arctic Ocean south to northern Mexico and as far east as the Mississippi River. When the first brown bears migrated into northern southeast Alaska around 12,000 years ago, they encountered an Arctic environment as giant glaciers and sea ice melted away, revealing the ABC Islands of modern-day southeast Alaska. There, it's theorized that brown bears met and interbred with a vanishing population of polar bears. To this day, the ABC bear's DNA is more like that of polar bears than other populations of brown bears, including mainland bears that live just 4 miles away across Stevens Passage, which separates Admiralty Island from the mainland of southeast Alaska. The Tlingit people likely arrived in southeast Alaska not long after the first brown bears.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?